In a work that we do, people want to know what is one of our biggest challenges. One of the biggest challenges in doing STEM work is that of mindset. And people think when we talk about mindset, we're talking about the mindset of the community. That is one mindset of belief gap that we have to work on. We deal with parents in the community to help them understand and believe what their kids are capable of, because so many people in the community have not had the experiences with doctors and scientists and engineers to believe that their kids can be that. As a matter of fact, that's why sports is so pervasive in our community, because before the age of four, before a kid reaches school, they've already touched a football and basketball, and football and basketball has been demystified for them such that when they get to school, they play football and basketball. When they come home, they play football and basketball. And the parents have the belief that if their kids stick with this football and basketball, they can go all the way and make $1 million. But the belief gap goes even deeper. When we go out and talk to funders, and funders don't value the kids that we are working with because they don't have the belief that the kids that we want to work with can do the things that we are trying to bring to them. So if the parents don't believe that the kids can do it, it's very difficult to get the parents to buy in and bring the kids to where we need them to be. And if the funders don't believe, then the funder's going to always shortchange us and devalue the work that we're doing and even put more value on programs and kids that they believe should have this type of programming. And that is the challenge. We must change the mindset and the belief gap around who's supposed to be doing STEM. STEM NOLA is doing that work every day. That's why we marshal the human capital and the technical capital back into communities so children and families and communities can see people who look like them, who walk like them, that talk like them, that actually came from communities like them doing this amazing work. So we demystify the STEM for everybody so they'll know that STEM is for everybody. STEM is for all.
From the STEM Global Action Studios in New Orleans, this is the Let's Talk STEM with Dr. Calvin Mackey podcast. STEM Global Action is a national leader in creating STEM-based learning activities and delivering them virtually and in communities around the globe.
Hello, and welcome to the next episode of Let's Talk STEM. I'm Ken Sang, your moderator. So let's get started. We'll start off by introducing our host and fearless leader, Dr. Calvin Mackey. Hello, Dr. Mackey.
Hello, Ken. Ken, once again, I'm very excited to be here. You know, it's been a while since we had an opportunity to talk to someone really doing the work. We've really been talking to people who've been doing policy and advocacy. But at STEM NOLA, we believe that you have to be where the rubber meets the road. And today we have Kate Ayers out of Memphis, and she's doing cancer outreach at the St. Jude Cancer Hospital in Memphis. And I'm just happy to have her here so we can compare notes and see how we can learn from each other and continue to engage kids all across this country.
Very good. As you said, our guest today is Kate Ayers. She's the Director of STEM Education and Outreach at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where their work is to increase diversity of the biomedical workforce and address inequities in K-12 STEM education. So, Kate, welcome to our show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great, great. So tell us about yourself, your journey, your professional journey, and we'd really like to know how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Yeah. So I have a background in biomedical research. I grew up in the Memphis, Tennessee area, which is where St. Jude is located. When I graduated high school, I studied chemistry in a university that's somewhat close to Memphis. And then when I graduated from college, I went to the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, which is located in Memphis. And I was actually studying biomedical research. So I joined a lab at St. Jude. As a graduate student, I studied structure-based drug design, but about, halfway through a PhD program, my mom became terminally ill, so I closed the master's early, and I decided to leave the lab, and I switched to go into the classroom. And so I ended up teaching at a local middle school. I taught middle school 7th grade life science for about 5 years before I transitioned back to St. Jude in education and outreach. And so I've been here now for 10 years. Doing STEM education and outreach.
Great. So tell us about the program that you run at St. Jude's. What's the focus of your work?
So, as you mentioned already, so I'm the director of the STEM education and outreach program. And the focus of that is really on career training and enhancement from kindergarten to 12th grade in areas related to science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine. So there's two M's in our STEM. And that's really to emphasize the integration of STEM in propelling the mission of St. Jude, which is to advance cures and means of prevention for pediatric catastrophic diseases through research and treatment. And so in addition to providing STEM educational opportunities for K-12 students and educators, then all of those are related to STEM problems at St. Jude. Another goal of the program is to target issues of equity in K-12 STEM education. And those are issues that really limit who gets to be a scientist and whose ideas matter in science. And so these are issues like racism, classism, sexism, ableism, which unfortunately still are working strongly in, you know, the city of Memphis, but really our country at large, to limit who can access these kinds of careers.
Great. Dr. Mackey?
Now, Kate, I see that that your ecosystem is a part of the STEM learning ecosystems.
That's right. Yeah, the Memphis. So St. Jude is the sponsor organization for the Memphis STEM and Medicine ecosystem.
Okay, well, STEM NOLA is a recognized STEM ecosystem of STEM learning ecosystems also.
That's
and, great. But Future Education Technology Conference is in New Orleans, and I had dinner last night with Gerald Solomon, one of the original funders of the STEM learning ecosystems. He's with the Samuele Foundation, and it's always good when I can meet somebody from another ecosystem. Can you tell us more about your ecosystem? You told us about your program at St. Jude, but how do you all bring it all together and work with different partners to engage your community?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're a fairly new ecosystem. We joined this past January. Well, I guess we've been officially a year because now we're back in January. So we've been an ecosystem for about a year. And really, though, we've all been doing this work. Like I said, I've been at St. Jude for 10 years. And so in those 10 years, of course, you're meeting other people in the city who are really trying to do similar kinds of work. But we are all working in a very siloed fashion. You know, you're doing this in STEM and in these schools, and I'm working in these schools, and we're all sort of working in our own individual pockets. But the idea was finally to come together and really begin to form a collaboration with this idea that we can do a lot more when we work collectively. And so it's really about that collective workforce and how can we collaborate to really do the transformative changes that are needed in the education system, especially in a city like Memphis, Tennessee, where we have such high rates of poverty that really are impacting, you know, the opportunities that students have, not just for STEM, but just for their futures in general. And so how can we then work collectively to help really bring about that kind of change, the transformative change that's needed?
So, Kate, tell us, what are some of the resources and experiences that your program provides to young people?
Yeah, we take a variety of approaches to addressing issues of equity and access to STEM learning experiences. So a lot of our work focuses on developing school partnerships, so to offer after-school programs within the school or hosting curriculum collaboratives to really work with the educators to co-create and integrate more science into the learning day. And that's especially true at the elementary school grade levels and in the elementary schools that we work in. We also host a research immersion program for high school students, now focusing primarily on high school juniors, where they have the opportunity to come on campus and receive mentorship from a researcher and really participate in the research process. And then we're also, so we are just now launching an online educational platform to try to expand our reach beyond the city of Memphis. And it's going to be related to data science geared towards high school students. And the idea is that we'll create online learning modules related to St. Jude data stories where students can actively engage in authentic research using data from St. Jude.
Got it. Now I see where you have a plethora of after-school STEM clubs and you have community health clubs and middle schools. What's the difference between your after-school club and your community health club?
Yeah, so the after-school STEM club targets fifth grade students. It's a little bit more structured. So students engage in a case study where they learn about a patient who shows signs and symptoms of disease. The students take on the role of physician scientists, and they analyze data to diagnose the disease. They ultimately learn that the patient has osteosarcoma, which is a cancer of the bone. And in those patients, a lot of times they'll require either a full amputation or a partial amputation. And then it sort of segues from the biomedical case-based curriculum to an engineering design challenge where the students work in groups to collaboratively create a prosthetic hand that can be used to, you know, so the idea is they use found materials and it can pick up a ping pong ball and put it into the ball. So that one's a little bit more structured. With the community health club, it becomes a lot more open and student driven. So in that one, they analyzed data on the National Cancer Institute state profile website, and that has cancer metrics from cancer mortality rates, cancer incidence rates across a variety of cancer types. And you can stratify it by social determinants of health. And so then students are asked to, you can also stratify it by geographic region. So students are asked to look at the state of Tennessee, Shelby County specifically, at a cancer that is most interesting to them. And they're asked to look for an inequity that exists, either a racial inequity or a socioeconomic inequity. It could be whatever inequity that, again, is most interesting to them. And then they're asked to think about, using the social determinants of health framework, what are some of the upstream, what we call upstream factors? So those are things like built environment, policy. What are some ways that we as a society are creating environments where these inequities can exist? And then if we're going to address root causes, how do we change the environment such that those inequities can no longer exist? And so through that, at the middle school level, they create a sort of public brochure that they could share with information around the cancer type, the inequity, and social determinants that drive that inequity.
So how these programs are funded?
Through St. Jude, yeah. So So it's really through the Comprehensive Cancer Center. So St. Jude, as the institution, yes, we treat a lot of cancers, but there's also other diseases that, like sickle cell, HIV, blood disorders in patients, just all catastrophic diseases in childhood. But then we're also a comprehensive cancer center. And so when you're a comprehensive cancer center, that is a funding mechanism through the National Cancer Institutes. And so in that, you're expected to do community outreach and engagement, career training and enhancement along the entire continuum. And now one of the newest components is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so my program really helps to fill that need for the cancer center and as part of that granting mechanism from the National Cancer Institutes of Health. So it's a combination, I guess, of the institution as well as the National Cancer Institutes.
Now, I mean, I ask because when you say the after-school STEM program, we have an after-school program funded by 20 federal funding from 21st Century after-school program, and we have corporations that sponsor our after-school program and whenever I'm in a school program and things like that. But Kate, I got a PhD in mechanical engineering and I hate biology. I mean, I hate biology. I hate chemistry. I hate medicine. This weekend we had a lung and respiratory day. And my buddy who is a medical doctor, he told the kids, watch this. And he grabbed the sheet pluck with the heart, the trachea, and the lungs. And he started chasing me around the gym because he know I hate that stuff, right? I mean, hell, I hate electrical engineering. I hate chemical engineering. I hate most engineering. And how do you take into account that little crazy Kelvin in your summer camp, but he really don't want to be a doctor. He really don't want to be a researcher. But he really not really even interested in cancer, right? How do you deal with little crazy Kelvin?
Well, I think, I don't know, little crazy Kelvin, but I think when we're talking about, of course, an after-school program, sometimes the parents sign the kids up and the kid maybe isn't choosing to be there. We actually find that a lot of our students are signing up because, especially younger kids, more social engagement, right? Oh, my friend's in the club, and so I wanted to be in the club. But I think that one of the things that we try to do with our programming, even though, yes, you might not want to be a medical doctor, maybe you aren't interested in biology, but I think that where we try to build that emotional connection is the why is this work important? So even if you don't want to do it, how is it helping either to solve problems in and for your community? So that's the community health club. You might not be interested in being a cancer researcher, but we all know people who have had cancer in our lives, and we all, really care about preventing cancers in our community. And so I think that that drive to want to be a helper, to want to support my community and solve problems for my communities is one thing that students really like about it. In the younger grade levels, it's interesting. It's kind of a similar thing that I think maybe is unique to St. Jude is because, yes, they're doing a patient case study and it's very much like a medical case study. it's a child. And a lot of them in the evaluations that we done will talk a lot about how like, oh, you know, this is a child. It could be my friend sitting in the class right next to me, and I'm really helping this child. And so they really feel that emotional connection to the work that's being done. And I think that that's one of the important things for young children is to understand, like, I don't want to just memorize about cells or parts of cells. That's not very much fun. It's not exciting. It doesn't make chemistry, I think, is a very exciting field, but it's often taught in very boring ways. When really they're, you know, it's dynamic. It's always changing. It's always evolving. And it looks different based on the environment and the circumstance. And I think when kids are seen in the context of the why is this important, not just for myself, but for my peers that are sitting in the desk next to me or to my community members whom I love and care for, then STEM starts to be something that's a little bit more interesting and exciting.
So, and Kate, I'm glad. Go ahead, Ken. There's one thing you mentioned earlier was that you guys, part of your program, you have mentorships for the young people. Just tell us, what are the benefits of that? Like, what do you see happening in that, both for the mentors and the mentees?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think, you know, mentorship is so incredibly important. And we really try in our programs to create multiple mentor points. So there's different types of mentors. And so it's more like a team mentor approach. And so, you know, for our younger programs, a lot of those are facilitated by undergraduate students who are themselves STEM majors. And so they get to see themselves for probably the first time as a leader in STEM, now leading these small groups of fifth graders or middle school students. And then for those middle school students and elementary school students, those become those near peer mentors, the role models that they can begin to look up to. And so it really is this bi-directional, that relational piece that's incredibly important where everyone is benefiting. In the older grade levels with high school students, especially who are coming in and their mentors are scientists in the lab, now that becomes someone who can give me career advice or who can sponsor me, could write a college application letter for me. And then again, for the scientists, I think something that can happen in science, because we think of science as like these great discoveries. And yes, those great discoveries do happen, but they only happen after decades of work. And so the day-to-day life of a scientist can really be kind of tedious and boring and repetitive as you're gathering data to tell your story. And so I think sometimes what can happen is you become disenchanted by the field of science. And that's when a lot of scientists will shift careers and go into other fields. But having a young scientist there can really help reinvigorate your excitement for the field, because everything's again new and fresh to them, and you can remember through them like, oh, I remember the first time I did this and it was so exciting to see that result. And I think that that's something that we often don't appreciate as scientists, the value that we get from mentoring young children as well.
Very good. Thank you.
One of the things that we do when we first introduce the mentor and the mentee together. So one thing is we actually partner our mentees. So it's not one high school student going into the lab by themselves. It's actually two going into the lab. And I think that's fairly rare in these kinds of environments. I think most of the time it's thought to be a one-on-one relationship. But, you know, what I have found is that for a lot of students, especially students where science is such a foreign concept, is it can be very intimidating to feel like you're the only one in the room that doesn't know what's going on. And everyone around you seems so, so incredibly smart. And so we actually partner our students. So they're not alone. They may not know, and actually they don't often know each other before they meet. So the two mentees are meeting, they're meeting their mentor. And one of the very first things that we have them create together is establishing their shared expectations and norms for the mentorship relationship. So really coming in and saying, how do you like me to communicate information to you? How do you receive communication? What do you want to get out of this? What is your role? What do you perceive my role is? And that way they're creating this sort of pact together for how they want that relationship to unfold and what they want the outcomes of that relationship to look like. And so it really focuses on relationship building. And if, you know, they're willing to commit to that, And then from there, they create an action plan together of, you know, what are the first steps that we're going to take to achieve whatever goals we've outlined for ourselves. And so I think what we really focus on is fostering healthy relationships where there's strong lines of communication. And not just that I'm communicating, but I'm communicating in the way that you like for me to communicate to you. I think that that's very important. And what are your fears? What are your hopes? And so really laying all of that on the table from the very beginning. And then, of course, there's members of my team who are always present in building mentorship relationships as well. And so we can sort of be an intermediary if we need to have some, you know, relationship conflict resolution or something. Knock on wood, have never had to deal with that yet. But I think that this coming together and really co-creating those, you know, expectations and norms for what we want to get out of our relationship as a mentorship relationship is key to really creating strong, positive relationships between the adults and students that we work with.
So Kate, you talked about the shared responsibility, and I know a lot about mentoring. I used to train the mentors and the mentees at NASA every summer. And I believe there's certain things that mentees need to know. But being in the STEM field nearly 25, 30 years, I am convinced there's some people that should be mentoring, that should not be mentoring students. A lot of our colleagues are demotivational at best. And if they want to stay in the lab and do research 99 hours a day, let them. And they should not be allowed to get in front of students and demotivate them from the possibility of becoming what they want to become. How do you all guard against the wrong people becoming mentors? And do you all have a mentor training program? See, a lot of people want to make sure that the kids understand what they're getting into and want to make sure that the kids know the expectations. But we have to make sure that these mentors understand the kids that they're dealing with, the environments in which they're coming from, and what they're getting in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think you're exactly right. And you're absolutely right. And so we really try to make sure that we're identifying scientists who have very strong sense of in themselves, right, of workplace boundary. I think what I heard you saying was some of these scientists are getting into the lab, they're working all the time, and that's all their life is. And of course, those aren't the kind of people who they probably won't even volunteer to be your mentor, right, because they don't want to give that time up to actually invest in training young people. And so we really try to make sure that they have the right mindset to want to be a mentor, and then absolutely training is key. And so all of our mentors in our program agree to undergo a training where they we talk about, you know, exactly what you're talking about, like where are these students coming from? What can we expect? What do high school students understand? You know, how can you as the adult in the space really work to establish and foster a strong, positive relationship? What do you do when, you know, your mentee gets frustrated? How do you help them overcome that frustration? And so we do a lot of training with the mentors. And then, of course, it's not perfect, right? You do sometimes have mentors that come in and aren't effective mentors. And either you think, okay, well, maybe they just needed some extra training in XYZ, or, you know, maybe they shouldn't be a mentor in the future. And so you sort of learn also who's good and who's not good through trial and error in some cases.
So I have a question for both of you. Like, how do you all see the roles? I mean, since you all have been doing this long enough and doing it well, what's the role of parents and families in the process? You know, how important is it? You know, Dr. Mackey, you mentioned, you know, Crazy Cow and his mother. And, you know, like, how important is it that kids have the support of parents and families when they're starting their STEM journey? Let's go to you first, Kate.
Oh, okay. I think parents are incredibly important. Of course, I think the role of parent changes as we move up in those grade levels. But ultimately, I think you're right, the parents are there to help support and lift up the child, but then also to help them find what are the opportunities, to help them persist when they want to give up. You know, I remember for myself, when I was in college, my freshman year of college, I wanted to drop out. I didn't want to be in college anymore. I wanted to go into beauty school. And my mom really encouraged me to continue in college. And I did. And I'm very thankful for that. And so I think they're the people who really help you to hone, like, who are you? What do you want out of life? What do you view as your best self? And then help you to achieve those goals and help you to identify if I don't have all of the skills, my parents were not science people, you know, if I don't have all the skills, how can I help connect you into the people who might be able to help you, or help you find programs that can help you get the mentorship that you need or the opportunity that you need. And so I think parents play a key role in helping develop young future thinkers.
Right. Dr. Mack.
Now, Ken, that's a loaded question, right? And it's loaded because that's why I think when I was talking to Kate and I was asking about the work that they do, and Kate runs a traditional organization that work, you know, in informal space and formal space. But I believe that's why we have to expand what we're doing. And what STEM NOLA has done, he expanded what we're doing outside of informal, informal, and into the community. Because I was talking to a philanthropic funder this morning. They said, what one of the greatest challenges that you face? It's one of the greatest challenges I face is the belief gap. I mean, the belief gap of not only the parents, the communities, and people who otherwise don't believe that this is for their children, or if don't believe that their children can do this. And on the other side, we face a belief gap from the funders and even educators who don't believe that these are the type of kids who otherwise can achieve in this space. So sometimes it is easy to say the parents should be doing this and the parents should be doing that. But if the parents don't know, how do we diversify, you know, STEM? How do we diversify STEM in medicine? How do we get to kids who otherwise need encouragement that otherwise is not even possible to get it from home, because mother and father and grandmother may not even know the pathway to get them into a STEM program. So at STEM NOLA, we say we've created a high-functioning STEM community. Kate, we say we are child-centered, adult-governed, elder rule, meaning that we focus on kids from cradle, from birth all the way to the 12th grade. We surround those kids with college students, and we pay those college students to engage kids in the communities and informal and formal spaces and then non-formal spaces. And then we surround those college kids with STEM professionals. My two kids grew up in a house where the daddy has a PhD in engineering, mother's a pharmacist. And if they wanted a PhD in the classroom, they asked dad. If they wanted a pharmacist, they asked their mama. But if they wanted an MD, I called my buddy. If they wanted an astronaut, I called my friend, Dr. Jeanette Epps. Hell, they wanted to meet the president of the United States, and they wake up every day with a picture with them and Barack Obama over their bed. But for Pookie, Ray Ray, Pedro, and Maria, and Shanita across the street, how do we marshal the human capital and the technical capital back into communities to not only just inform them, but to inform the parents of what's capable of their kids, and then let them know the pathway of getting there? So parents play an amazing role. But I think in this entire ecosystem conversation, Kate, and this is the conversation I've been having at the highest level of the ecosystem, they must be a community component. They got to be when we don't have a community component, we are already wiping out what we call lost Einsteins, kids who otherwise, and a new study came out this week that was in, I believe, Journal of High Ed, that said the disparities in STEM start before kindergarten. They start before kindergarten. So if we're starting at the schoolhouse door, and now the research saying it starts before then, you see why I'm so passionate and committed to making sure that we get to parents and, you know, not only inform the parents, but let them know they have a trusted partner in us that will give them the information that they need. So, of course, they play a role. But we got to also understand that there are many parents that don't even know the role to play, even if they want more for their kids.
Got it. So thank you, Dr. Mack. Kate, we're about at time. So, but before we leave, just one last question. Are you excited for the future of young people in STEM education and then taking that into careers?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, one of the things that we really, and I think this speaks a lot to what Dr. Mackey was talking about, right? So this idea of community. And so I think, you know, I am very excited for the future of our world. But I think that we have to do it in very intentional ways. And, you know, I think acknowledging that education debt, which I think is what Dr. Mackey was referring to, right? This idea that there are children who, and let's be honest, right? It's Black and brown children who have not been served by our education system. And that becomes generational. And so through these generational debt that has been accumulated, and that's a term coined by Gloria Lansing Billings, right? To really sort of shift the conversation away from achievement gaps. It's not a gap, it's a debt that's owed. And so we have to work as communities, right, to make sure that we are paying tribute to that debt that is owed to these communities that have not been served. And I think that the only way we can do that is exactly what you were talking about, is through these ecological models of development, STEM development in this particular case. And so when I think about the work that we're doing in the city of Memphis, I get very excited to think about the opportunities that we're working to provide. And it's not enough. There's nowhere near enough. You know, we're in 24 schools. There's 92 elementary schools in the Memphis-Shelby County School District. It serves over 70% of those students are living below the poverty line. Mm. About 70% of them are coming from Black and Brown communities. And the history of our city is like the history of many cities in the city of Memphis or in the United States, right? It is a history of racism, a history of classism. So we had, we had forced segregation, forced integration that led to choice segregation. And so now that history still lives with us today, and it's a living history. And unless we come together as a community and really decide how do we want those possible futures to look? And I think where we send our kids, how we raise our kids is very important. Obviously, I'm coming from a white community, a white member of the city of Memphis, but we send our kids to Memphis Shelby County Schools because my husband and I became aware that, you know, you can't just live in a bubble. You have to raise your children with other kinds of people so that they don't grow up with the racist narratives that we grew up with. And so we want them to be different. And that gives me a lot of hope for the future. Just, even outside of just science and STEM, I think seeing how less racist our young people are is hope. I think seeing how less sexist our young people are gives me hope. And that is what we need to diversify science and STEM, because science and STEM, for the most part, is still seen as a career for white children. But we don't want it to be just a career for white children. And it shouldn't be, right? Science and STEM, again, is a tool that we can use to care for our collective well-being. And we can use it as a tool to solve problems in and for our community. And we have a lot of big problems in our community that need to be solved. And so we need these young people using those tools to help us solve these problems. And that gives me hope.
No, and you're using my word now. Hope is my word. I often say hope is that little voice in your head that whispers maybe when the whole world is screaming no. And many of our kids in a place called America, every day they have people telling them no. And then take people like you, Kate, and the work that you're doing, and the work that people like my buddy Mecca with Code Crew in Memphis are doing, to whispering in kids' ears every day, regardless of what society is telling you, we're going to whisper, you know what? Nah, we're going to shout, yes, yes, you can do it. But Kate, one thing that we must, you know, that we have to answer before you go is, why is diversity in medicine even important? I mean, you know, I'm Billy Bob. I'm sitting under the tree. I got my bottle. They're talking about all this diversity stuff. Man, the Florida governor of Florida said, you know, AP African-American studies lacked educational value. Why is diversity in medicine important now?
Yeah, I think there's two really strong reasons why diversity in medicine is so important. So I think the first reason is, right, that there's research that shows that diverse teams are better problem solvers. And a lot of the problems, you know, we look at St. Jude work, childhood catastrophic diseases, that's a complex problem. And it's not going to be solved by any one individual. We need interdisciplinary teams of experts who can work together and help us solve these problems. So diverse teams make better problem solvers. But then I think the second reason, especially in medicine, why diversity is so important is because of the history of abuses that have been inflicted by the field of medicine on our marginalized people groups. And so that history has led to a lot of distrust in medicine, and rightly so. You know, so representation, who is on these interdisciplinary medical teams working to help solve the problems in human health, that matters. It matters to make sure that our research is done ethically. It matters to ensure trust in the people we're trying to serve with the medicines that we develop. It matters because these individuals can work to ensure that the humanity of these marginalized people is recognized, and that their thoughts, beliefs, and cultural practices are considered in that decision-making process. And so I think that for both of those reasons, diversity in medicine are incredibly important.
Hey, you knocked it out the park, and it matters in front. It matters, you know, in terms of the medical doctors, but it also matters in terms of the researchers. It matters in terms of the practitioners. I just wrote an article recently for Forbes. The title of the article is Diversity in STEM is a Matter of Life and Death. And in this article, we talked about that the pulsometer, the one device that we used during COVID to measure the amount of oxygen that people was, you know, was taking in during COVID, was inaccurate for people with high melanin pigmentation. So meaning that many Black people got wrong readings from their pulsometer that really caused some people to die. We went even further to talk about how the genome therapy that's used to target cancer, some cancers, is inaccurate for people with different pigmentation. Now, I was a PhD. I'm a PhD from Georgia Tech. I was a professor at Tulane for 12 years. If I'm working on something that otherwise going to impact me, why would I release it knowing that it is inaccurate for me? And some people think that science and STEM is cut and dry. 1 + 1 = 2. 3 + 3 = 6. Why do we need diversity? We need diversity because people are making instruments. People are making calls. People are diagnosing people that otherwise, if they don't care about them, you know, they'll just let them be. So yeah. I want to say this, Kate, thank you for your work. Thank you for being here with us today. I look forward to working with you. I gave a shout out to my man, Mecca, with Code Crew. Mecca and I went to Morehouse. We do a lot of work together. I was just in Memphis a couple of months ago speaking at his annual fundraiser. So nice. I'm probably going to come visit you in Memphis because we got a lot of things to do together. And I'm definitely interested in, you know, finding out more about what you are doing and seeing how we can incorporate it in our work here in New Orleans, because we partner with Oxygen Healthcare System, the largest healthcare system in the state of Louisiana. And anything that we could take that other people are doing to better serve our community, we are very open to it. So again, thank you for all that you do. And if you need me, holler. You know, just call me. I'm like Tupac. I ain't hard to find. Just Google me. And StemNola will be there for you.
All right. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Kate, for joining us. And thank you, as always, Dr. Mackin. But most importantly, we want to thank you all for joining us here on Let's Talk STEM. You know where we are. We're available on everywhere where you get your podcasts. Come back and see us soon.
You've been listening to a STEM Global Action podcast. Through our STEM-based programming, we put students on the path to quality jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math. Visit us at www.stemglobalaction.com. Until next time, let's keep talking STEM.